So today we are very happy to have John Simon coming from visiting us from the University of Chicago. So today he will be telling us about making quantum matter from light. John.
Great. Thanks, Junwoo. I really enjoyed having lunch with some of you. Very stimulating chat. Hopefully there'll be some time at the end for more discussions. Let me just say in general, I will not be offended by people interrupting with questions while I'm speaking. Maybe don't draw on the slides without asking, but if it's going to be something cute, even that's fine. I like cat pictures. Anyway, it's a pleasure to be here. And what I'm going to tell you about is work going on in my group and in collaboration with Dave Schuster's group, developing model materials from photons. And so I think maybe a good starting point is to ask, when I say we're going to make materials out of photons, what do I mean by materials? So that when we make one, I can declare victory and we're speaking the same language. So when I say a material, I mean a collection of particles that interact with one another and thereby sort of organize order. So let me give you a simple paradigmatic example of this kind of idea. What I'm going to simulate down below is a bunch of little balls. Each one of those blue dots is a ball. And it has some mass, and it attracts each of the other balls when they're far apart and repels it when they're close together. And additionally, I've added a little bit of friction to this model. So those are all of the ingredients that I need to get these little balls to organize into a classical material. So the point is that what I needed was, one, a collection of particles, that is to say, some relationship between the velocity of these particles and their momentum. And then I need interactions between the particles, something that changes the momentum of one particle dependent upon its separation from another particle. And then I need some way to take entropy out of the system to cool it down into an ordered state. And so what we're going to try to do is realize these ingredients for photons, but in a regime where the quantum uncertainty in the locations of the photons starts to matter and entanglement is generated through the collisions and so forth. But the key is going to be to realize these three ingredients. One, to make particles with some controllable dispersion, to make them interact, and then to reduce their entropy. So the first problem we're going to run into then is that forces don't really slow photons down. If I have a massive particle moving to the right and I apply a force on it to the left, it slows down and then moves to the left. If I have a photon here that's moving to the right and I apply a force to the left, it turns from red to blue. That's not what any particle in a material should ever do. It should slow down. So why does this happen? Well, fundamentally, the point is that the dispersion of light is linear. The velocity of a photon is always the speed of light because the derivative of the momentum of the energy with respect to the momentum is constant. So what we're going to need to do to make photons behave like massive particles and respond to forces in sensible ways is trap them in some kind of a medium that lets us manipulate their dispersion. And so that'll be some kind of a metamaterial. So that's challenge number one. Challenge number two is that the electrons in the material collide with one another, which means that when they get close together, you get this collision, and then they go out in different directions. They can exchange momentum. Well, of course, we know that Maxwell's equations are linear, so if I have one solution for a photon moving to the right, another solution for a photon moving to the left, then in fact, the sum of those two solutions is also a solution, and the photons go straight through each other. So we need some way to engineer interactions between these photons as well. So what is that going to look like? Well, we can take some inspiration from how electrons collide. Electrons collide by exchanging virtual photons. So maybe you say photons could collide by exchanging virtual electrons. I'm sure for this audience, I don't need to say that this is not allowed by all of the things. But you can make more complicated diagrams that make this allowable. The problem is that for the sorts of photons we're talking about, sort of optical energies, the cross-section for this process is very, very low, meaning that for one photon in the EV range to collide with another one, that second photon would need to be compressed down to a cross-sectional area of 10 to the minus 56 microns squared, or a radius of like 10 to the minus 28 microns. And of course, a visible photon, an EV scale photon, can only be really focused down to its wavelength, which is about 1 micron. So we're about 28 orders of magnitude away from this kind of approach working for making visible photons collide with each other. But we can take some inspiration from this idea. We can use matter to mediate interactions between photons. We just have to create a situation where instead of having the photons have to turn into an electron-positron pair, which costs much more energy than the energy of the photon, we should use something that's more resonant, more on shell. And so what we will eventually do is create a situation where one photon presents a cross-sectional area of about 100 microns squared, or a radius of about 10 microns for another photon to collide with it. And so that will allow us to eventually make materials out of photons. The other challenge is that we need some way to suck entropy out of this system of photons. But the point is, the way we were sucking entropy out before was by adding some friction to the system. So you might say, well, the system's more quantum mechanical if we don't add the friction, but then you get that the photons are just kind of bouncing around like graduate students at a cookie hour, right? It never cools down and organizes. So what we're really going to need in practice is some way to controllably remove entropy from the system and then potentially either turn off that entropy sink or make it local or some such. Okay, so just in terms of the general taxonomy of the science that we're talking about here, these ideas that we're going to explore are condensed matter physics ideas coming from systems of in the solid state, where the story is basically you have electrons that interact with one another through the Coulomb interaction, and the dispersion of the individual electrons is determined by their mass, but also the kind of ionic lattice potential of the material. There's a well-explored story in a cold atom context where you replace the interacting electrons with interacting atoms and you replace the ionic lattice with an optical lattice. And there's a whole cold atom community exploring this kind of science. What we're going to do, in fact, is replace the electrons with interacting photons and manipulate the dispersion of the photons either with optical resonators or with arrays of microwave cavities, depending on whether we want to study continuum physics or lattice physics. Okay, and so the two stories then are one about continuum physics in optical cavities and the other in lattice physics in these arrays of microwave superconducting cavities. And I'm going to try to arrange the time such that...
Can I ask you a question? Is there
absolutely
an advantage to using photons versus atoms, or is it just different?
It's sort of a complicated question. I would say that there are several advantages to photons over atoms, and there are several advantages to atoms over photons. I've taken out the slide comparing the absolute numbers, although I can bring that up for you at the end. But to me, the real point is that... photons naturally move extremely fast, and so to get them to be slow enough that you can do this kind of physics, you have to really slow them down, either by trapping them in high Q cavities or by using only a small transverse part of their momentum or something. But what this means is that you now have a lot of cool tools at your disposal for model building, using the fact that the photons are actually moving very fast, right? So you can create, one thing we're pushing on now is making wormholes. So you could have a manifold that the photons can move in, but they can also essentially teleport from one region to another because all of your physics takes place slowly in the plane, but if you let the photon leave the plane, you can bring it from one spot to another. So that's one piece of the story. The other thing that I would say makes photons really cool compared to atoms is this idea that it's very easy to engineer the electromagnetic vacuum using all kinds of different resonators. And so the point is, if you want to do some kind of dissipative cooling or non-Markovian reservoir preparation, or particle injection where you inject to or remove to, many of these sort of quantum information-y kinds of ideas at the interface with material science play much better with photons than with atoms, right? That is to say, the atom systems are sort of naturally totally closed and completely local. And for the photons, you have to work a little harder to make them closed. But if you turn that off, you have all kinds of richness in the open system degrees of freedom. Mm-hmm. And we're getting to the point now where we can make them as closed or more closed than the cold atom experiments. So opening them back up is actually a very, very powerful kind of a tool. The coherence of these, particularly the circuit systems that I'll talk about in the second half of the talk, is really quite extraordinary.
I see. Interesting. Okay. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Can I ask one yes. really dumb question here, which is you say that in these resonant cavities, you're looking at continuum physics, uh-huh. but you still have, you know, discrete energy levels in these systems. You still have, any photon in any particular level is sitting in some very particular location, although its wave function is spread out over the whole cavity. So in what sense, what is really the distinguishing thing that you're saying when you say continuum?
Okay, so I will show you that in more excruciating detail than you could possibly want in a couple slides, but let me give you the short answer. Would you agree that a particle in a harmonic trap sort of lives in the continuum?
Sure.
Right. I haven't made a lattice for it. It lives in a continuous space, and yet quantum mechanics tells us that it can also live in discrete eigenstates, right? And so I would say, in some ways, that's sort of the statement for the optical cavity. It's going to behave more like a particle in a harmonic trap, and less like a particle that can hop from one latticeite to another. And in fact, when I say it's going to behave more like a particle in a harmonic trap, it's going to behave exactly like a particle in a harmonic trap. So let's see what I mean by this story. So again, for each of these platforms, what I'm really hoping you can take away from this is the kind of model building that one can do with photons for exploring strongly interacting sort of Hamiltonian models of many body physics. Okay, so we're going to learn about how to control the photons and make them behave as particles, how to make them collide with one another, and kind of a couple of different tools to assemble them into many body states. So this is the end of the kind of introduction. I guess we probably don't need to really take a break here because I've been getting questions during, but if people have things they want to ask, now is a good time. That's Emmy the cat. I know everybody's wondering. If you're lucky and you behave well, you will get to meet her at the end. Okay, so let's talk about optical photons. So the central premise of this story is that photons in a multimode optical resonator behave like massive particles in a harmonic trap. And these kinds of ideas have kind of been explored in exciton polariton experiments and photon BEC experiments, just to give you some context. But what I'd like to do now is kind of explain what exactly this analogy is so that we can harness it going forward. So the picture I want you to have in mind, we have these two cavity mirrors shown here in blue. And what I claim is that if I inject light into this cavity off center and I create this purple pulse, and I don't watch its movement back and forth along the axis, I just watch its transverse motion, I claim that it'll oscillate back and forth like a massive particle in a harmonic trap. Well, one way to see that is to really trace the rays as they bounce back and forth in the cavity. And what you can see is if you just watch where those rays cross this middle plane, you get kind of like a stroboscopic evolution of a massive harmonically trapped particle, kind of a Poincaré map of that particle. But we can actually even be more formal than that, if you'd like, which is, first, let's look at a quantum harmonic oscillator. The eigenstates of a quantum harmonic oscillator are Hermite-Gauss in space, and they are uniformly spaced in energy. And it turns out that, in fact, the modes of an optical cavity are also Hermite-Gauss in space, and uniformly spaced in energy. Now, as you might notice, there's also a longitudinal quantum number. I'm just telling you about the transverse quantum numbers of the cavity. And we're just thinking about a single longitudinal mode index for now. So the photon is actually delocalized over the whole cavity length longitudinally. So now the idea is, if I have a photon that I inject into the cavity off center a little bit to the right of the middle, I can write that as a superposition of the lowest mode of the cavity in this first excited mode. And these two will actually constructively interfere on the right side and destructively interfere on the left side. And that produces this off-center bump. But the point is that this first excited mode evolves at a different frequency than the lowest mode. So half a cycle later, this plus sign has become a minus sign, and now the photon has shifted to the left side of the cavity axis. So this story should look very familiar. This is how a coherent state oscillates back and forth in a harmonic trap. Now, so the point is that a photon in a cavity behaves very much, and in fact, formally, mathematically, identically to a massive particle in a harmonic trap. So the picture you should now have in your mind, this is a slightly more artistic rendering of what's going on, but you have these two mirrors. The photon is delocalized everywhere along the cavity axis, and oscillates back and forth transversely like a massive harmonically trapped particle. Okay?
What sets the mass?
Yeah, so this is, so I can give you a formal answer. That's what I was gonna tell you next. But there's okay. a physical intuition as well. What you can say is that if I have a ray propagating in a cavity, so I've got this cavity here, okay? Mm-hmm. And I have a ray propagating at an angle to the axis. Okay. What you can see is that the thing that prevents that ray from just bouncing back and forth and going upward forever is the curvature of the mirrors, right? So in some sense, the curvature of the mirrors is providing harmonic confinement. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And what you would say is that in some sense, the tilt of this ray is like the canonical momentum. Not the mechanical one, and we can go into that if you want afterwards, it's subtle. And the relationship between the momentum and the velocity is the mass, right? And so the point here is that on a round trip through the cavity, if these two mirrors were flat, the amount by which the ray gets displaced on one round trip tells you about the mass of the particle. The more it gets displaced for a given tilt, right, the lower its mass is. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the sort of physical intuition for what's going on. Mathematically, I can say, if I have some field in this initial plane at the left edge of the cavity, which is psi of x at z equals zero, and then I wanna know what the field is at the other end of the cavity, there's gonna be some operator that propagates from one end to the other. There will be an operator that reflects me off the mirror. There will be an operator that reflects back and an operator that reflects me off the other mirror. Okay. So the question is, what are those operators? Well, the statement is the field at the far end of the cavity is equal to the field at the input end times e to the I kz times L. But the problem is, what is kz? Well, kz is really the k of the light squared minus the transverse momentum squared. So when I Taylor expand that, what I really get is that when light propagates down a cavity, diffraction is really like free evolution of a massive particle, right? Where the mass here looks like K over L. Does that make sense, Mina?
Yeah, it does.
Okay. So now when I reflect off of the mirror, I get a phase which is quadratic in my transverse location, an e to the I kx squared over 2r, okay? And then when I propagate back, I get this e to the minus free evolution, and then reflecting off of the other mirror gives me another e to the I kx squared over 2r. So that says that round trip evolution can be written in terms of e to the I h flow k times the round trip time, where h flow k is written as the logarithm of this crazy looking operator. But the point is that because this is a quadratic operator and the commutation relations between x and d by dx are fairly simple, this ends up mapping quite nicely onto SL2R, SL2C. And so you can do all of this algebra in closed form and actually derive a quadratic Hamiltonian for the photons. If you want to read more about that, you can look at this new Journal of Physics paper from my group. But the important point is that we now have a formal understanding of how photons behave in these optical cavities, where you can see that the free propagation basically gives the photons mass, and the mirror curvature gave them harmonic trapping. So you might say that's two of the three types of quadratic terms that you can have in your Hamiltonian. This is a p squared term. This is an x squared term. The other interesting term is an xp term, which corresponds to a magnetic field. So is there a way to generate a magnetic field for these photons that live in this cavity? And the answer is that twisting the cavity will actually give that to you. So what does twisting mean? Let's talk briefly about periscopes. I think this will give you some intuition on this story. If I look at a tree through a periscope, we can trace the light through. The tree is vertical outside, it looks vertical inside of the periscope. Great. But what about if the top mirror is rotated by 90 degrees relative to the bottom mirror? Well, then what you see is that the tree comes out rotated by 90 degrees. And in fact, the orientation of the tree depends upon the relative orientation of the top mirror with respect to the bottom mirror. And this is kind of like a discrete version of parallel transport. But the point is now, if I made a cavity from these two mirrors, plus two more to close the round trip, I could create a situation where on a round trip through the cavity, the light gets rotated a little bit in one direction or the other. Okay, so imagine a four mirror cavity that I twist out of the plane like this while keeping the mirrors pointed at each other. And the idea is that twisting the cavity out of the plane kind of turns the lab frame into a rotating frame. I still have all of this dynamics that I'm used to of the mass coming from the length of the cavity, the harmonic trapping coming from the curvature of the mirrors, but now twisting the cavity out of the plane turns the lab frame into a rotating frame. Okay, and the interesting thing here is that we know how to handle a rotating frame. We get a Coriolis force.
Your sound went a bit quiet.
The Coriolis force looks like omega cross P. And a centrifugal force is basically an outward force that increases linearly with your radius.
Oh, John,
this Coriolis force, omega cross P, is equivalent to a Lorentz force, just a V cross P, right?
Hello, John, you've gone kind of quiet on it.
We just cancel with the mirror curvature, and that should leave us with
maybe his sound is off too. Hello?
And we've really created a Lorentz force.
Oh, well, I can draw on his thing.
Sorry, I'm getting your question in the chat.
You are quite like a quieter.
My sound is off, maybe. Uh-oh.
Yes.
Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Is it still too quiet?
No, it's better.
No, it's
okay.
Oh, it's okay.
Okay, good. Good. I don't know. I don't know what that was. So anyway, are we clear on this to this point, or should I repeat what I just said about?
No. I think it makes sense, but other people can chime in. I think it may be better to just repeat
the last
quickly.
Slide.
Yeah.
Repeat the last slide. So the point is, twisting the cavity gives us turns the lab frame into this rotating frame, because on each round trip through the cavity, the light kind of gets rotated a little bit around the cavity axis. And so this really literally corresponds to a Coriolis force on the photons and a centrifugal force, in addition to the harmonic trapping forces and the kinetic energy terms that we already had. And so the point is that now this Coriolis term, which is omega cross P, is equivalent to a V cross B. And someone is asking, do I mean the polarization? Which I think is a great question. The polarization does get rotated, but I'm talking about the spatial profile of the light also. And in fact, I'm not even worried at all about the polarization, just the spatial profile. So the thing that's interesting here, for the most part in the past, when people have talked about topological physics with light, it's usually in the polarization sector, because that's simpler. And similarly in cavity QED, when people talk about quantum physics in a cavity, they're usually talking about in a single mode of the cavity. Here, as we've already seen, to get the photon to look like a massive particle, you have to talk about multiple modes of the cavity. And so this rotation that we're generating is also a spatial rotation about the cavity axis. So we're again talking about in the actual spatial degree of freedom. Okay? And so the point is that this Coriolis force is equivalent then to a Lorentz force, right? Because P is MV, basically. And so we basically generated a magnetic field along the cavity axis that creates a Lorentz force on the photons. And this centrifugal force term is like living on top of a bowl, you know, just a radially outward force that increases the further out you go. And you can just cancel it with mirror curvature. So what you should expect is if I have a four mirror cavity like this in the plane, it's going to correspond to a 2D quantum harmonic oscillator. Okay. That is to say it has a lowest eigenmode. It has these two first excited eigenmodes. That one's excited along X, the other's excited along Y. It has three second excited eigenmodes and so forth. But the neat thing here is that as I twist the cavity, these can no longer remain eigenmodes. Why? Because the definition of an eigenmode of your cavity is under a round trip, that mode comes back to itself, right? That was this whole Floquet story we were just talking about. And this can't come back to itself because it has to rotate a little bit due to the twist. So the point is we need some superposition of these two modes that is invariant under rotation. And it'll be this X mode plus I times the Y mode. It'll be a ring. And so what we'll find, and this is again just in numerics for now, as I twist more and more, one of these ring modes goes up in energy, the other one goes down, and I make this family of rings of increasing size, and in fact, 2 pi, 4 pi, 6 pi, 8 pi of phase winding around them. So really what I'm making is a Landau level for photons. Okay? And I should say, I've been talking about this in the language of quantum mechanics. Can everyone still hear me? Some weird stuff flashed on my screen.
Yes.
Okay, good.
We can still hear you. We're just shuffling.
Weird. Is it okay now? Is there still shuffling?
Yes. No, it's good.
Okay. But I should say that while I've been using the language of quantum mechanics, the point is that the Landau level comes about because these are the eigenstates of the Schrodinger equation, which is a wave equation. And more or less what we've done is make photons obey the same wave equation. So you can think about this physics as being totally classical so far, but physics for classical electromagnetic waves. But you can also put single photons into these orbitals, as we will do shortly, and study the physics of strongly interacting photons in these Landau levels. Okay? So there's a whole story that I think I will skip for now on photons on a cone, but let me just say that you can do what I've just described to you experimentally, and we do. And more or less what you see is that by tuning the length of this cavity to this degeneracy point here, we can make these modes of this lowest Landau level degenerate to a megahertz-ish. And that means that if we can make the photons interact by more than a megahertz, we can get the modes to hybridize to make few photon Laughlin states of light. And now the story that I could tell, but I think I will basically skip here, is that one can measure churn markers on this Landau level and see that it has a churn number of one. There's also a whole story that I think is probably best to skip about the curvature associated with photons living on a cone and measuring mean orbital spins and central charges. This is just to say that there's some very bizarre and interesting physics in the single particle sector. But this is supposed to be a talk about making quantum materials out of light. And so I think the next important thing to discuss is how to make these photons collide with one another. So the basic idea is to use something called Rydberg electromagnetically induced transparency. So imagine I have a photon moving along and it hits this blue medium. So the idea with this medium is that when a photon enters the medium, it slows way down. Well, of course, photons always move at the speed of light, but if they've been absorbed by atoms, then they can't move at all because there's no photon anymore. And so the idea is the photon comes in, gets absorbed by an ensemble of atoms living in this lowest atomic state, and it excites one atom to this 5p state. And whichever atom gets excited to the 5p state is then excited by a very strong laser to a Rydberg state. And because that Rydberg state is very, very long-lived, the photon can propagate through this gas very slowly. But the interesting thing here is that we're using a Rydberg state that's got an electron orbital radius of like a micron or two. So this is like the 112th Rydberg state is what we're using. So this is neat because if a second photon tries to enter this gas, well, if it's near the first photon, those two Rydberg electrons would essentially interact with each other and collide. And so what this means is that when a second photon enters, it actually cannot excite an atom up to this Rydberg state because the Rydberg state has been shifted by the electron-electron interactions. And so as a consequence, if the second photon gets near the first photon, it propagates fast. That's what I've shown in yellow. But if it's far away from the first photon, it propagates slowly. And so that just looks like a lens. And so when the second photon enters, it lenses off of the first photon. And scatters through the medium. And so what this means basically is that the medium mediates interactions between these two photons. Okay, and then we just do this inside of a cavity. So what you should have in mind is these photons that are delocalized along the cavity axis, bouncing back and forth many thousands of times, and moving back and forth in the transverse direction due to some harmonic confinement or Lorentz forces, and dragging an atomic excitation along with them. So you can think of these photons as sort of polaritonic quasi-particles that can interact with one another through the atomic medium. So what does this look like in practice? Well, I guess you can all see my background. That's what the apparatus looks like in practice, but that's potentially not that informative. Now, what we do is we load a magneto-optically trapped sample of atoms, shown here in kind of brown, and that gets loaded, let's see if you can still see my finger, into that region of the vacuum chamber right there. Okay, that's a high current coil that we use to laser cool and trap atoms in that region. And then the atoms get loaded into a lattice and transported up into a cavity, which is there in the picture. And then once they're in the cavity, this is an actual image of the atoms, an absorption image. And the light goes through this atomic cloud. So this is about the size of the cavity mode going through the cloud. It's about 10 microns across. And this is the like 100 micron atomic cloud. We make the cloud very thin so that atoms at one end of the cloud can interact with atoms at the other end so that we effectively have a 2D cloud. No extension in the third direction. And then we start doing physics with this thing.
Sorry, can I ask you a question? So why is this, so where, I mean, the fact that these things are Rydberg states just comes in because they are long-lived? Why is it important? I mean, why don't you get these kind of interactions, for instance, in usual polaritons?
Yes. So the deal is it's very important that the electronic orbitals of the Rydberg states be several microns in size. Okay, a typical electronic orbital is about an angstrom, a nanometer at biggest. Okay, and the challenge is, you know, you can only make a polariton about a micron in size. You can't make it much smaller than that because that's beyond the diffraction limit of the light. Does that make sense? And so if your polaritons are a micron in size, even if they're on top of each other, the probability that they're interacting with the same atom is basically zero. And so all you can ask is, can the two atoms that are excited by the two polaritons interact with each other directly in their excited state? Or equivalently, how strongly do two excitons interact with one another? Does that make sense?
I see.
And if your excitons are, you know, there's some advantage in for excitons because their binding energy is weaker, so their Bohr radius is bigger. And also from the dielectric constant of the medium that the excitons live in, but basically they just can't interact over micron kind of distances.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. So for instance, yes. Okay. So yeah. The only things that I'm familiar with is like these dark state polaritons. You're saying that those things that people build, these interactions just don't happen because their sizes, the size of the orbitals, is just not right.
Exactly. So okay. in the excitons, the interactions are either an actual Jaynes-Cummings interaction, which requires that the two polaritons interact with the same atom and try to make one exciton.
Right.
But you need a lot of atoms to get strong coupling, so that's not usually what does it. What usually happens is it's phonon-mediated interactions between the polaritons, and then you need a lot of them to generate enough phonons to have a strong interaction.
Oh, I see.
Attach is pushing on these ideas, Attach Imamoglu, and he's been using these fractional quantum Hall polaritons. He has lots of really cool ideas for how to make it better. But right now, you know, our polaritons are very much in the strongly interacting limit, like very deep in that limit. And I think it's the only system with polaritons that are like that, basically.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you look at a spectrum of this cavity, right now I want to do a little bit of single mode physics with you, just to give you a flavor of how all of this goes. If you look at the spectrum of this cavity, you get a vacuum Rabi splitting for the experts. That corresponds to a hybridization of the cavity field and p-state excited atoms. If that doesn't mean anything to you, don't worry about it, because we also don't care about those vacuum Rabi peaks for today. What we care about is this cavity EIT peak, this middle peak, which corresponds to creating a quasi-particle, which is part cavity photon and part Rydberg excited atom of this ensemble. Okay, and because these Rydberg atoms interact very strongly, we can now ask how strongly do these polaritons interact with each other in practice. So in a single mode limit, you should really think of this object as like a quantum dot. So I'm going to send light into this cavity. I expect to be able to put one polariton in. One photon can go in. But if a second one tries to go in, this peak will be shifted in energy. So the second photon won't be able to go in. It'll reflect off until the first one leaves. Okay, and so this is kind of a transport blockade kind of phenomenon. So to give you an idea, this whole cavity has a length of like 6 centimeters. So this is a very macroscopic object that I'm claiming can only hold one photon at a time. So you can look at and see if that's true in spectroscopy, but what's more interesting is to ask, given that I just saw a photon come out of the cavity, what is the probability that I get another one out immediately afterwards? And what you can see is after about 20 microseconds, I'm pretty likely to get another photon out of the cavity. But right after I detect one leaking out, I never get a second one. And what that says is that this cavity can only hold one photon at a time. This is a macroscopic thing, 6 centimeters on a side, or 3 centimeters on a side, that can only hold exactly one optical photon. So we're now very deep in this strongly interacting limit. And the last question one might ask here is how to put these ideas together to make topological, I'd say topological many body states. You might call them topological few body states, or even topological two body states. So far we're using this to make two photons collide. So I think what I'll do is very quickly tell you how this works. And then refer you to the paper for technical details, because what I think is more exciting for the last couple minutes is to just introduce you to the Circuit QED platform. So the idea is basically this. The experiment that I described to you just now was to inject light into this lowest mode of the cavity and see that once I put one photon in, I cannot put a second one in because this two photon state is shifted up in energy. Okay, so I get a blockade phenomenon, the second photon can't come out. What I think is really neat is if you now try to do this for the L equals one state, this first excited state of this lowest Landau level, something weird is gonna happen. You two photons in this state will have an energy shift, but two photons in this L equals one state can also collide and conserve energy and angular momentum by becoming one photon with 0 units of angular momentum and one photon with 2 units of angular momentum. So now to figure out if the system's really blockaded, I have to diagonalize this two-state manifold. One of the two states is 2 photons with 1 unit of angular momentum, and one of the two states is a photon with 0 units and a photon with 2 units. So you can do that diagonalization formally if you want, but let me just show you what the answer is. This state has no interaction energy, okay? Why is that? Well, just to be clear, Z is X plus IY. So this is like a first quantized way of writing a 2-photon wave function, okay? If Z1 is equal to Z2, then the wave function is 0. The photons are in the same location, and that's not allowed by this wave function, okay? But the interesting thing is if I expand out this quadratic, the 3 terms that I get are Z1 squared, Z2 to the 0, and note that Z2 to the 0, e to the minus Z2 squared is this orbital, and Z1 squared, e to the minus Z1 squared is this orbital, right? And this term is 2 photons in the L equals 1 orbital. So what this is saying is that this state is a superposition of 2 photons with 1 unit of angular momentum with a state where 1 photon has 0 units and 1 photon has 2 units, okay? And the really cool thing here is that this state that I've just written down here is the 2-photon bosonic Laughlin state, okay? And so the idea is that if you inject classical laser light into your cavity, what comes out on the far side is 2-photon Laughlin states. That's the light that leaks out of it. So you can think of this as kind of a Laughlin filter generated by the strong interactions between the photons. Now, I should say that we have a nice paper demonstrating this. Let me just provide you with the reference. Where is it? There it is. We have a chat.
Yeah. So can I ask you something? So how confident are you? How efficient is this process?
Yes, great. So what I was going to say is we've got this paper where we demonstrate that we can make these Laughlin states. In practice, at this point, the process is extremely low efficiency. And the reason is that our collisions aren't quite deterministic enough. Because our atomic density isn't quite high enough. This was sort of a proof of concept.
Actually, so, there is a question in the comments. How many atoms are in the cloud? Like, how many atoms do you have right now? And how many would you need to make it more nearly? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So right now, sitting within the cavity volume of the modes that we're looking at is probably 500 to 1,000 atoms. Not very many.
No, that's not a lot. How many would you need to take it very high efficiency?
I think we would like to get another factor of 1,000. And in fact, if you look at the densities that we're operating at, we operate at like 10 to the 10 atoms per centimeter cubed. It's quite straightforward to win another factor of 1,000 on those densities. We haven't done it for technical reasons having to do with Rydberg EIT, and we need more blue laser power for the polaritons to be long-lived. Basically, you need strong coupling on both the ground to P transition, which is where the atoms provide the strong coupling, and strong coupling on the P to Rydberg transition, so that these quasi-particles that we make don't get torn apart by the collisions, right? Because the collisions occur in the Rydberg manifold, and if you don't have enough blue power, then the atoms can't follow. The ground state, the photons can't follow, rather.
Yeah.
Another question. Let's see, what is it? How stable is all of this? I'm not sure quite what you mean, Robert Mann. Maybe you could unmute yourself and
how
answer.
Stable. Yeah, I just wondering, you've got this cloud in there, can it stably sit there for a long time, or
is, yeah, so like, the, So it's actually, that's a great question. The challenge that people used to run into is if you try to trap your atoms, and we can trap our atoms, but when one tries to trap them, the trapping fields that trap a ground state atom basically tear the electrons off of the Rydberg atoms, just because those electrons are not very well attached. And in fact, the trap certainly doesn't trap the atom anymore because it was an optical trap that was relying on the polarizability of that, you know, valence electron to hold the atom in place. And so what we've discovered is that basically, if we make our atoms cold enough, we don't succeed in trapping the Rydberg atoms, but we can make the trap so shallow that their electrons don't get torn off. And so the whichever atoms we're doing the science with may eventually be lost, whichever one gets excited to the Rydberg state. But basically, it doesn't destroy it during the experiment. So we can do these experiments repeatedly for hundreds of milliseconds. Ryan Plested asks, how would we scale this up to many photons? So I think 100 would be a lot. I think 10 or 20 is more reasonable. And we would do that instead of by trying to inject photon by photon, where you get kind of an n factorial fidelity suppression. It's really terrible. What you do instead is something called dissipative stabilization of the many body state. And so maybe what we can do is, if Ryan wants to hear about dissipative stabilization, we can talk about that briefly afterwards. Let me just point out that we have this other project where we couple two cavities together and use one to make a wormhole for the other that we're pushing on now. That's theory. The experiment will be online soon. And then we can make Laughlin states in the presence of wormholes. And the story that I was going to tell you about microwave photons, but we'll tell anyone who's interested afterwards, is basically about the idea that you can start to build models in this same kind of spirit for microwave photons in lattices. And the essential idea there is that you trap these microwave photons in LC resonators, where you replace the inductor with a Josephson junction, which is basically, as far as we're concerned here, an inductor whose inductance depends on how much current is flowing through the junction, but it depends very sensitively on how much current. So you can have a situation where the first photon that this resonator holds is a 4.5 gigahertz photon, and the second one is 4.2 gigahertz. So that's like the photons attract each other by 300 megahertz, okay? And now you can couple these resonators together with capacitors and make lattices where the photons can tunnel from one lattice site to another deep in this strongly interacting limit. So we can have interaction energies of 300 megahertz for photons that live for 50 or 100 microseconds. So that product is like 12,000 collisions within the lifetime of the photons, which is actually quite comparable to what you get for cold atoms in an optical lattice, where the photons interact at hundreds of hertz to 1,000 hertz times Planck's constant, but they only live for a second to 10 seconds. I can chat with you about that a little more afterwards, but I think right now probably the sensible thing to do is highlight the people who did the work. So these are all the people who did the work except this guy, the handsome one in the middle, sat in his office and watched cat videos. The people really in charge on the circuit side, which I didn't tell you so much about, were Dave and our postdoc Alex Ma. And on the twisted cavity side, Nathan Schein really pioneered these twisted cavities. And Logan with Nathan pushed very hard on these Laughlin experiments. So with that, thank you.
Thank you.
You can, yeah, do this.
Yeah.
I guess questions?
Well, we've asked many questions during the
talk. You've asked a lot of questions during, so Don't feel bad if you just want to go back to your, I mean, I guess it's what, it's 3 p.m. there. So during quarantine, that makes it beer time, right?
All right, I have a question.
Yeah, you either come out an alcoholic out of quarantine.
You said you wanted to make matter out of light, but how many atoms are in this material? At the moment, not very many, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, and I would even say that the thing that I'm thinking of as the material is actually the photons or the quasi-particles. And so it's like two. So maybe you'd call it like a topological molecule if you wanted. And in fact, on the microwave side, we make it out of, we make mod insulators of microwave photons up to like 8 photons, right? It's not a lot of particles.
So how many do you think, like the microwave side's better? I mean, how many do you think you could get there in, let's say, 5 years?
It's an interesting thing. I would say, you know, getting up to hundreds is quite reasonable. But I think there's an interesting question at some level of, you know, up to what point does quantum mechanics fundamentally determine the properties, right? Philosophically, my intuition has been that if you've got enough particles for most systems, you will eventually get some kind of hydrodynamic effective description of the behaviors, right? And I definitely feel like once you get to that point, it doesn't behoove you to have to make the system bigger. Now, you might say, well, what about many body localization, right? Like, you should be able to study thousands of particles, right? And see quantum only phenomenology. But I think the challenge is that the scaling with coherence requirements is just really extreme with the number of particles, right? In the sense that the more particles you have, if you're in a limit where one particle decoheres your many body state and makes the interesting quantum physics go away, more particles probably means to see the quantum physics you needed more evolution time, right? But now your many body state is decaying faster. So I guess I have my doubts about whether the really exciting science for us is going to be studying properties of 10 or 20 or 30 particles or trying to boost up to thousands. Does that kind of make sense,
yeah. Robert?
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have more questions?
I have a quick question. Is there any back action from the Rydbergs?
So this is a really interesting thing. You might worry that the atoms recoil due to absorbing the photons and then re-emit in a different location. And we've sort of started to model that there's a regime in which the motion of the atoms can thermalize into the polaritonic sector.
Okay.
Right. And so I think that's one type of back action you might think about. The challenge is that the polariton mass is effectively determined by the photon mass in the cavity, right? Mm-hmm. Because the atoms are so heavy by comparison. So,
and remind me, the photon mass is set by 1/k, so it's set by the wave numbers?
It's a little more complicated than that. In practice, what you have to do is compute that Hamiltonian by taking that algorithm.
Oh, I see. It's like really once you do a round trip, there's an effective mass that comes out of that. I see.
Yeah. Have you heard of ABCD matrices, no. Right, for ray propagation? It turns out all of this amounts to this SL2C is the algebra of 4x4 matrices. And so at the end of the day, you end up having to take a logarithm of a 4x4 matrix and a particular matrix element. You get a tensor mass. But if you work hard, you can make that diagonal with the two eigenvalues equal. But what you get out at the end of the day is like an electron mass, basically, okay. For the photons.
Okay.
But the point is, that means that your polaritons have to live a goddamn long time for the atomic motion to thermalize in at all, right?
Oh, okay.
We're just,
I see.
We're just not there yet.
It's very slow.
What time scales are we talking about now?
Well, what I would say is it's not totally clear what you should compare to exactly.
Yeah.
But the polariton lifetimes are a few microseconds.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
And the atoms, what you really need is for your atoms to move a wavelength, right? And at some level, if your atoms move a wavelength fast, really fast, they just destroy your polaritons.
Yeah.
They Doppler shift things out of resonance. And if they do it slower, then they're sort of effectively stationary, so it doesn't matter so much. But I do have to say, for these dissipative stabilization ideas, one thing we've been thinking about is to use the atomic motion to cool the photonic degrees of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because there's back action in both directions.
Mm-hmm. I see. That's interesting.
Right, that is to say, if your polaritons lived long enough, they could transfer kinetic energy into the atoms through the Rydberg-Rydberg interactions.
Right.
That would then cool the polaritons down.
So these dissipative techniques you're talking about, you're trying to figure out the analog of like cooling atoms, but where you're trying to cool this light matter. Is that right?
So maybe I can show you a quick picture of what we do for microwave photons, okay?
Sure.
So there, the basic thing that you should have in mind, we kind of make like a chemical potential for photons. Let me just briefly share my screen again for you here. Can you see that?
Yep.
Okay, so here's the basic idea, Ryan. My mouse is gone. Okay, whatever. The idea is, if you have this Bose-Hubbard model, which is more or less what you realize with this array of coupled transmon qubits, right? Where the number of photons in each of these anharmonic oscillators is like the number of particles in a single well of a Hubbard model, okay? So what we would like to do, if you start with just that system, the photons just all evaporate, right? And then you're left with, great, you have a Hubbard model that's in its absolute ground state. The absolute ground state is no particles, right? What we really wanted was the ground state at a fixed particle number,
yeah.
Right? So how do you realize that? Well, in cold atoms, what they do is they, you know, adiabatically prepare the many-body ground state in a weakly interacting limit, right?
Yeah.
That's, or not adiabatically, they prepare that by cooling.
Yeah.
And then they adiabatically turn that into whatever they want by tuning the Hamiltonian. But we're not trying to copy cold atoms. We want to do something which is nice for photons. So what we would like to do instead is create a chemical potential for light. So what that means in practice is an object that can provide photons of a particular energy, but not other energies, okay? And it can never take photons back.
Okay.
So you should think of this object on the left here as that chemical potential. So the idea is if it ever empties, it refills itself.
Okay.
Okay. And its energy is the same as the energy to put one photon into this Bose-Hubbard chain. So the point is that first photon can hop in, but
yeah.
Before it can hop back, that site refills itself.
Okay.
Okay. And now the photon in this refilling site can't hop into the chain because the photons strongly repel each other until that first photon hops over, and now this one can hop in, and then this refills itself. Okay? And so what you expect is kind of something like that. And the point is, in fact, this kind of an idea works well for any incompressible phase of matter. That is to say, where dE dN for the ground state is fairly stable with particle number,
yeah.
Until you hit a compressibility gap, and then it costs a lot more energy. So, you know, fractional quantum Hall states are these sorts of states for the most part. Mod insulators are these kinds of states. Superfluids are not, right? But
right.
There are a lot of interesting compressible phases. So
sure.
Now we just need a way to make this green object on the left. And it turns out that's a very easy object to make. And this was this reservoir engineering idea. Essentially, all that you need to do here, can you see my mouse now?
Yeah.
Yeah? All you need to do is have this cavity, or this resonator, which is nonlinear, okay? So this is zero photons in it, one, two. And what we want to do is drive it from the zero state to the two state, and then force the two state to rapidly decay to the one state.
Mm.
Okay? Because you don't want to drive your laser between zero and one, because then that can also take a photon out, which is not what you wanted. Yes?
Yeah.
So the point here, and what's really cool, is that to enhance the decay of the two state to the one state, you have to couple your qubit to a reservoir that has a high density of states at this energy and a low density of states. And that's just an LRC circuit.
Okay.
Right? So this is what I was saying at the beginning, Mina. We now have this ability to have non-Markovian reservoirs, right? Frequency dependent dissipation, right? Realized just by superconducting circuit elements with the addition of resistors. So now this object really dissipatively prepares you in this one photon state, and you can couple it to a Hubbard chain, and it really works. It really makes a mod insulator of microwave photons, right? Pardon?
So when you say a chemical potential, like what you showed was really a pump, but I guess in the equilibrium limit that acts like a chemical potential. Is that the idea?
Yes. So we've been struggling with what exactly this object is, right? You could imagine that if it supplies particles up to some particular energy and eats particles over another energy range, then it would behave like a chemical potential. But right. I think a piece of what's challenging is, what is a chemical potential dynamically? We don't ever actually really talk about the dynamics of a chemical potential. We talk about, you know, what particle density it stabilizes your system at or something. Or at least I haven't really thought about how it works dynamically. So one question is, do you get the equilibrium steady state from this that you expect from a chemical potential?
Yeah, sure. Right? That's the ultimate. That's what you're engineering towards. Yeah.
But then that's the interesting question that we're starting to investigate now. It's not clear that it always does, right? You can think of limits where it does, but that's also made us wonder, to what extent do all the things that we think of as chemical potentials in solids really behave as chemical potentials? What you find is that this pump kind of xenosuppresses the quantum fluctuations for sites that are close to it.
Okay.
Right. The argument being, you're continuously making measurements of the right with this decay channel there. Right. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I understand. You're so checking the thing there, because if the thing's there, you can't put something in, and so you're...
Exactly.
I see. So it makes it harder for that thing to hop, then. That's the idea? It makes the hopping harder?
It can make the hopping harder, but it can also, like in a mod insulator, you expect doublon hole pairs and string order of those pairs over the system. So the thing that we're looking to measure now is, to what extent are those doublon hole pairs properly delocalized? Right. The point is, you should be able to have virtual processes where, instead of having one particle per site, this one can hop onto its neighbor, and it's there with an amplitude of the tunneling energy divided by the interaction energy. Right. But if, when it does that, this one refills it, it messes things up. So, but the further you are from that stabilization site, the less that happens. The further from the pump you are, the less it happens. And so one thing we're trying to figure out is there a good language to describe this? And is this something that you expect anytime you put a quantum system in contact with a reservoir to cool it down, right? That the part that's close to the reservoir has its quantum fluctuations quenched by the reservoir. Anyway, I think it's sort of a cute set of questions. And then the other question is, how to extend these ideas to the photons, which is the other thing that we're starting to do, or the optical photons, sorry. Yeah?
Yeah, that was a great answer. I think I've taken up my share of questions.
By the way, let me release everyone from the talk, and I'm going to stop the recording. Thank you so much, John, for giving us such a great talk.
My pleasure. I hope you enjoyed.
But I'm going to stop the recording, but we can continue discussing, and whoever wants to stay, they're welcome to stay. Okay. So thank you so much, everyone. Have a good day. And thank you, John, again.
Yeah, my pleasure. And please don't feel obligated to stay. You know, it's but while you're deciding whether to stay, I'm going to grab Emmy the cat.
Okay, I'm not going to stop the recording. Do you bring Emmy the cat?
Come here, Emmy the cat.
The reverse effect. You
know? We're going to finish with her cat. The recording is going to end with a cat. There it is. There's the cat. There's
Hello,
Emmy.
Hello, everyone.
Hello. Okay, I'm stopping the recording now. Bye, everyone. Okay.